Good evening. Welcome. My name is Ellen Aitken, and I'm the Dean of McGill's Faculty of Religious Studies. It is the faculty's pleasure this evening to join with our colleagues in McGill's School of Environment in welcoming to McGill tonight's speaker, the Reverend Canon Sally Bingham, for her talk, Shared Purpose, A Religious Response to the Climate Crisis. And I also want to acknowledge gratefully here the support of the Anglican Diocese of Montreal's Centre for Lay and Continuing Education and Canon Tim Smart for their support of this event. Sally Bingham comes to us from San Francisco, California, where she is the founder and president of Interfaith Power and Light, a not-for-profit organization dedicated to mobilizing the resources and energies of congregations of faith across the United States to respond to the pressing concerns of environmental concern and especially climate change. I'm sure that Sally Bingham will tell you more this evening about Interfaith Power and Light, but let me say that it is a truly remarkable organization for building strong interfaith coalitions of Jews, Muslims, Christians, Buddhists, Hindus, Jains, and those of other faiths at the local state level to do the crucial work of translating religious commitment, reflection, and tradition in order to engage in direct action with regard to what individuals and communities can do as responsible citizens of the whole earth. This Interfaith Power and Light involves over 10,000 congregations in 38 states of the United States. Much of the work of Interfaith Power and Light, and many of the concerns that Sally engages in her work, are those which are addressed and explored in the teaching and research of parts of the Faculty of Religious Studies and the McGill School of Environment, not least in our undergraduate teaching. And it's been a special privilege yesterday and today for Sally Bingham to interact with a number of students at McGill during the course of her visit here. Sally Bingham is an Episcopal priest ordained in the Episcopal Diocese of California and serving as the canon for the environment in that diocese. That is, the person with a direct mandate in the church for leadership in the religious response to issues of environmental concern. She has been active in the environmental community for over 25 years. Active isn't strong enough a word. Deeply concerned, driven, if you will, to close the gap between talk and action, between belief and advocacy. She recently joined President Obama's Advisory Council on Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. Is also a member of the Forum on Children and Nature. She serves on the board of directors of the Environmental Defense Fund, the Environmental Working Group, and the U.S. Climate Action Network, as well as on the advisory board at the national level for the Union of Concerned Scientists. Interfaith Power and Light and Sally Bingham have received numerous awards, including the 2007 U.S. EPA Climate Protection Award, the Purpose Prize, the Energy Globe Award, and commendation as a, quote, sacred gift to the planet by the World Wildlife Fund. She has been named one of the top 15 green religious leaders by Grist magazine and has been recognized as a climate hero by Yes magazine. In addition, she has received honorary doctorates of divinity from the University of the South, which gives me pride since it's where I did my theological training, the Church Divinity School of the Pacific, and the College of the Holy Cross. She is also the lead author of a book, a truly wonderful collection of essays, a book called Love God, Heal Earth, which is a collection of 21 essays on environmental stewardship by a number of religious leaders of a very wide range of communities of faith. And this is available, Sally assures me, on Amazon. So it is our delight to welcome this warm, winsome, and doggedly determined speaker to McGill. After her talk, there'll be time for question and answer and some discussion, which my colleague, Professor Peter Brown of the School of the Environment, will moderate. And so without further ado, as they say, I present to you Sally Bingham.
Thank you, Ellen, and I also want to thank Peter Brown for instigating the invitation to come and speak with you. I almost don't know where to start, but let me start with standing behind a podium. When I walked in, they said, "Do you want a podium?" And I thought, well, I dressed like this so that I would be comfortable behind a podium. So I chose it, and it is where I'm comfortable. So that's why I'm at the podium. And the other thing I want you to know is that that title canon, which you heard when I was being introduced, a lot of people don't know what that is. It's an ancient Anglican title for people who are involved around the diocesan house, the cathedral, who live on the close, essentially. That's probably not why I was called a canon. I was given the title of honorary canon by Bishop Mark Andrus just recently and installed in one of the stalls at our cathedral in San Francisco. And I promise you, he won't say this, but I know it's true. I am our diocesan loose canon. And he did that because he cannot keep me quiet, nor can anyone, about the connection between faith and the environment and my, well, Ellen said it, my passion to convince people that if one sits in the pew and professes a love for God, you have to be a steward of God's creation. So loose canon I am. But putting all jokes aside, I want to tell you about a campaign, Interfaith Power and Light, that offers hope in what some people think are dark times. And I admit that occasionally I am close to despair. Sometimes I think we are really in dark times. Will we or will we not recover? And those of you who know the science behind the changing climate probably struggle as much as I do with what are we doing to ourselves? We are dealing with economic recession, terrorism, severe environmental degradation all over the world, along with the increasingly scary signs of runaway global climate change. Climate change is a daunting issue, and it typically invokes feelings of loss, hardship, unfairness, and very often confusion. And those feelings are real. They are just as real as the climate crisis is real. And it sounds scary. But there's hope in the fact that we are at a moment of opportunity. And it's a rare opportunity. There's something bigger than the feeling and the fear of the climate crisis. We have a chance to come together with a shared purpose. And it's something that few generations have had the chance to do. And while crisis means danger, it's also an opportunity to work together. And this is a chance to redefine the human purpose. Why did God put us here in the first place? What is our purpose? And we might consider coming together with the purpose of healing the earth so that we and the next generations may live in health and safety. Isn't that, and shouldn't that be, our shared purpose? But back to climate for a moment. If we accept that the changing climate is going to affect all of us, then we share a responsibility to do something to save ourselves from ourselves. We need a cultural shift in the way we think about and use energy. But the challenges that we face in making these necessary changes are huge. And I'm going to refer to, because I know it better than I know Canada, the situation in America, but I think you will relate to this. And just for example, there was a coal mine explosion in the United States this year that took the lives of 29 people. Coal is the most dangerous and dirty of the fuels that we are using. And besides mining through tunnels where we put people miles underground, coal is also extracted by blowing the tops off mountains. Not only does that destroy the entire ecosystem in the vicinity, I think it is a sin against creation and an insult to God. 11 men lost their lives in an oil rig explosion, causing the worst oil disaster in American history in the Gulf of Mexico. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Agency, NOAA, announced that the planet has just come through the warmest decade, the warmest year, and the warmest last 6 months on record. Now here's the challenge. In light of that information, the United States Senate utterly failed to pass any energy, climate change, or even oil spill response, any legislation governing those things. And at the same time, they voted to preserve subsidies to the oil industry. And this is what we are up against. This is the challenge that we in the United States face, and you do here to some extent. Now, I'm going to make a serious charge, and with it, I take a bit of a risk. I said it in one of the classes today. It's not something I've talked about publicly, but I do believe this to be true. There are senators and elected officials who have done their own studies around climate change. They know that it's a problem. They've sent their own trusted scientists off to Alaska to look at the Antarctic, to go to Bangladesh, to see the people in Tuvalu, an island in the South Pacific where the sea is rising. And yet they won't vote for climate legislation. The charge that I'm going to put on these folks is that they are committing crimes against humanity. They know better. And with the overwhelming evidence that humans are making the biggest contribution to this problem by burning fossil fuels for energy, and these folks knowing that climate change has already harmed thousands of people all over the world, and yet these folks, the ones who know it's a serious problem, they won't vote for legislation that would curb greenhouse gas emissions. Isn't that a crime? And isn't when you're harming the poor and destroying the future, it seems to me it's a fair charge. Where is the moral integrity of our legislators? And how can they put re-election ahead of what's best for their country? And certainly what's best for the people and vulnerable people around the world, as well as for the preservation of the planet. Now, scientists told us 30 years ago that we would have more and longer periods of hot weather. And this summer in Russia, people were dying due to the heat, heat that had never been experienced before. The scientists said that the droughts would be longer and more forest fires would happen. Australia is in a 7-year drought, and this summer Russia was on fire. Scientists said that there would be much heavier rain and more severe flooding. 1/5 of the country of Pakistan was underwater and thousands of lives lost. China had floods and unprecedented mudslides. Now, these are the extreme weather conditions that we were told would happen, not necessarily being caused by global warming, because we've always had drought, we've always had fires, we've always had torrential rain. But they've never been this severe, and they've never lasted for as long as they have. And that's what the science was telling us. My daughter lives in Bozeman, Montana, and this summer they had hail that was as big as a tennis ball, and she had to have the roof repaired on her house. Cars were damaged from these heavy balls bouncing on the roofs of their cars. Now, none of these conditions have ever, ever been recorded in history. And this is just the beginning of what some people say is going to happen. There are insurance companies that no longer insure or provide insurance for homes on coasts in many parts of the world. So what do we do? If the government won't regulate carbon dioxide and oil and coal companies continue to gush carbon dioxide into the atmosphere for increased profit, who and what is going to motivate the change that we need? We are people of faith, people who see the climate change and environmental degradation as a moral issue. We start with becoming aware of the situation, and then we elect officials, politicians, who will represent and work for the best interest of our country and yours over and above politics and party lines. Now, for people of faith, this challenge is probably our greatest one. It is the moral challenge that will decide our relationship with God, with each other, and with the natural world. If we love God, and we love what God created and loves, aren't we the ones to protect and cherish our world? And if God so loved the world that he gave his only son, aren't we obligated to take care of it? So all nations and people are threatened by the changing climate, and we need to unite around this common cause, this climate crisis that all of us face. And some folks wonder, what does this have to do with religion? And I hope that by the end of this talk, you will see that without a doubt, the climate crisis is more than anything else a religious one. Christians, Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, and all mainstream religions of the world have a responsibility to serve, to speak for people who cannot speak for themselves, which is the next generation, to love one another, and to be the stewards of creation. That is probably the most important reason for our involvement in energy and climate issues. It is in direct disobedience to the commandment to love one another that wealthy nations have, through their pollution, destroyed the very basic stability on which poor nations and communities depend. It's the people who contribute the least to the problem who suffer the most. A justice issue, if there ever was one. Stepping aside for just a moment, most of us learn our values or our ethical outlook early in our lives. And more often than not, we learn those values from religion or whatever religious tradition we or our families belong to. It's the moral high ground, if you will, doing the right thing for the right reasons. So what does it say about us if we continue to do something that we know is harmful? Not just harmful to us, but harmful to people, animals, and the next generation who have no voice, but will suffer the consequences. We have to question our values. The poor and low-income communities, both in the United States and in Canada and around the world, are paying for mistakes, and not always mistakes, but they're paying for situations that were created where they had no knowledge and no contribution to. This is an issue of human rights. We must restore a shared sense of purpose. We all, rich, poor, and everything in between, share this fragile planet, and we all need to share the responsibility for keeping it safe and healthy for every living thing, human and non-human, and for future generations. There are solutions on the horizon, and our grassroots Interfaith Power and Light campaign is promoting many of these solutions. We, and hopefully you all, will help lead the way. Energy efficiency, conservation, and education. And we hope, too, that our campaign will have political influence through a values-based message, not a Republican or a Democrat or a Green or Independent or a Liberal or a Conservative, and I don't remember quite what the other two parties here, but not a political issue. People of faith bringing a values-based message. We have 10,000 congregations participating in this program, and our campaign, I think, will be a large part of the moral influence that this movement needs. And we are the hope in the dark times. The religious community is the hope. Our generation has the opportunity to engage in a cultural revolution similar to the one that happened 200 years ago, but this time a clean one. The Gulf oil disaster is an example of humans taking great risk with nature, and it certainly makes clear a powerful case for using less oil and getting ourselves onto clean, renewable energy. There has never been a solar spill. Prevention of that kind of a disaster is paramount. We should never again take the risk of destroying the whole coastline of the Southern Hemisphere by not having the proper safety measures in place. Not the Southern Hemisphere, the southern part of the United States. The United States, more than any other country in the world, is, however, divided over this issue. But whether or not you think that our warming climate is human-induced, most people would agree that the solutions addressing climate change line up with the solutions that will save a broken economy. It will encourage investments, create jobs, and increase national security. So you cannot argue that those are not good goals. So when it's been made clear that the renewable energy sources like solar and wind power generate 4 to 6 times as many jobs as coal plants, you can't help but wonder why we don't make the switch. Switching to a carbon-free energy will help rather than hurt the economy, and it's safer and cleaner. And this is the message that the climate skeptics don't want you to hear, but it's a message that we need to all emphasize in times of economic uncertainty. Whether you believe in global warming or not, switching to a low-carbon economy is something that we should all do anyway. In Copenhagen last year in December, and another conference is coming up again in Mexico, we did not get a legally binding reduction treaty among all the nations of the world. But every time there's an international conference on climate, we do inch closer and closer to real solutions, and there was some progress. Some of the good news is that for the first time, the United States, along with other countries, made commitments to provide $100 billion a year in funding to help developing nations adapt to changes in sea level rise and other threats that face them due to climate change. China and India were totally engaged in the summit meeting, and that was a first. There was global consensus among governments, businesses, artists, scientists, youth, and the faith community that climate change is real and happening. More people from around the world recognize that global climate change is a problem. Something must be done, and done quickly. Inaction now will only cost more later. Inaction now will only cost more later. The faith community has an important role, and we're positioned to have a strong influence all around the world. Major social changes do not happen without the moral voice of religion, and that voice is needed now. And I think that we will be the voice that pushes and creates real change. It will be the voice that brings the world together with a shared purpose. In the United States, there has long been a clear separation between church and state. Yet our democracy is best when all voices are heard in the political process. the moral responsibility to be good stewards of the earth fits side by side with our human desires to provide a safe and healthy world for our children. People of faith can no longer be silent or afraid to speak out. And you don't have to believe that humans are warming the climate not to recognize that reducing energy consumption, boosting renewable energy supplies, is the single best prescription for lifting us out of an economic downturn. Propelling a global economic recovery that isn't based on exploitation or degradation of the environment, but rather based on a smart and sustainable approach that will democratize the energy supply and enrich regional communities and economies. I see the climate crisis as one of the most, if not the most, important moral issue of our time. And when moral and economic priorities align, as they do now, there is no justification for inaction. And the world is looking at the Western world, at the United States particularly, and at Canada, for leadership. And why should we expect other countries to do something that we all talk about, but we are not doing anything about? Some of you may know that China is making great strides in developing a low-carbon economy, and that China is going to quickly become the world's leader in clean energy technology unless we step up soon. But the best hope for all of civilization right now is that people of faith stand up and voice the moral responsibility of a nation to protect its people from potential catastrophic disasters. And it is happening. Religions are not waiting for international treaties or for government regulation. They're putting faith into action. An example of that is that last November, almost a year ago, I was invited to go to Windsor Castle as a guest of Prince Philip and a man named Martin Palmer, who runs ARC, which is the Alliance for Religion and Conservation. They invited religious leaders from all over the world, and they asked us to make pledges as to what we would do in our communities in the next 3 to 5 years. The whole idea was that Ban Ki-moon would go to the Copenhagen conference with this little book of pledges from the different religious communities from around the world. And the message he was taking was, the religious community wants an international world treaty on greenhouse gas reductions, but whether that happens or not, the religious community is not waiting. We are going ahead with doing the right thing. And just for example, the Tao in China said that in the next 3 to 5 years, they would put solar panels on every single one of their temples. Besides the religious community efforts, there are other signs of hope. America has a century-old love affair with automobiles, and that romance may be fading. Last year, there were more cars scrapped than purchased, and people are buying smaller, more efficient cars now, too. The business case for protecting the climate is so compelling that 80 United States corporate leaders, including CEOs from companies like eBay, Virgin America, Pacific Gas and Electric, they all signed a joint letter in January of 2010 urging President Obama and Congress to pass comprehensive climate and energy legislation. And some businesses are leaving the U.S. Chamber of Commerce because they disagree on their stand on the climate problem. All the way on the other side of the world, in India, the Delhi government has made a commitment to close its coal-powered plants, the dirtiest fossil fuel, over the next 4 years and replace them with cleaner-burning natural gas-powered plants. You all may have heard another piece of good news, which is one of the world's most famous skeptics, a man named Bjørn Lomborg from Denmark, a scientist, well-known as a climate skeptic, just reversed his position and has admitted that he was wrong. People are beginning to get this message in a very powerful and meaningful way. But as far as I'm concerned, The most exciting and hopeful thing is that the faith community is now taking action. And we're not talking about doing something, as you can tell from the Windsor story. We are doing it. The Interfaith Power and Light campaign is not waiting for federal government, but we're acting on our own. I mentioned the Tao in China, and there are others. In Tanzania, the Lutherans are replanting 3 million trees on Mount Kilimanjaro. And we have something called a carbon covenant where people can help contribute to planting those trees. We're helping some Buddhists in Cambodia who are trying to stop illegal logging. It's through Carbon Covenant, which is on our website. So our 10,000 congregations are doing things like putting solar panels on their roofs, putting in geothermal systems, installing energy-efficient appliances, which they can buy from our website at a discount, developing creative liturgy to help change hearts and minds. Churches, mosques, and synagogues are serving as examples to the community. They're organizing and they're joining a grassroots movement, which is what I think the environmental crisis, the climate crisis, has missed out on. We need a real movement. Our clergy are walking the halls of legislative buildings and talking to lawmakers. And this is what they did during the civil rights movement. And many credit the faith community with playing a decisive role in that successful effort to commit to convince politicians to do the moral and right thing that supports the common good. So climate change doesn't have to be all about gloom and doom. Reducing consumption of fossil fuels such as gasoline can be good for your health. Walking, biking for short errands will not only allow you to cut carbon, but it'll help shrink our collective waistline by increasing exercise. Getting out of one's automobile can help you develop a deeper connection to God's creation. You're closer to the natural world, closer to the flowers, closer to the grass, and other natural beauty. This is not about sacrifice. It's about stewardship. And it can be joyful, the joy of giving. When I go into my garden and I dump food scraps from the table into my little black compost bin, and then I'm able to dig it back up several months later to plant vegetables in, or if I walk the 2 miles to Grace Cathedral on a Sunday, I feel that I'm giving back in exchange for the abundance that I and many of us have been blessed with. I don't feel deprived, and I don't feel like I'm a martyr making some profound sacrifice. It's quite the contrary. I feel good about not making waste, and about being able to use the soil from the compost, and about saving gasoline for when I truly need it. And it's fun to experiment with ways to save energy and to prevent waste. Doing the right thing is not always the easiest, but for people of conscience, it's the only thing to do. Now, for the last 10 years, I've worked almost exclusively on a religious response to global warming. The Regeneration Project, which is the umbrella organization for Interfaith Power and Light, was founded in 1997 when I was still in seminary. And the mission is to deepen the connection between ecology and faith. And then in 2000, we launched our Interfaith Power and Light campaign. I'm just giving you a little background. When I was ordained and started this ministry in 1997, there were only a few people who had made the connection between our faith in God and how we treat God's creation. And addressing global warming was received unenthusiastically at best. I was called a communist. I was accused of bringing a political issue into the church, mixing church and state. I was a promoter of world government. And what did I as a priest know about science anyway? Now, while I admit that I'm not a scientist, I have been closely following what they're saying about the health of the planet, and I believe that scientists are today's prophets. I think we need to listen to them. And in my view, without the science, religion wouldn't have a prayer of moving people. And that's because there are still enough people who want proof before they will accept any idea or challenge. That's why we need the science and why we need to work together. Science tells us, however, that we have but a scant few years to turn this trend around in order to avoid catastrophic weather conditions and unprecedented sea rise, which will put entire nations in the developing world at risk. We therefore have to all work together and curb our energy use in order to slash greenhouse gases that have been linked to climate change. To limit carbon dioxide, which is, I keep repeating, the most serious and prevalent greenhouse gas, everybody needs to work together. No one segment of society can do this alone. This is our shared purpose, and we have a shared responsibility to turn things around. While moral obligation should compel us to act, the message that we might consider sharing with the rest of society is that this action is paramount to help the economic benefit, to encourage economic benefits that will flow to society. If we do these things, economic benefits will flow to society. If we consume less energy and we shift to more sustainable and non-polluting renewable fuels, we will be safer and healthier. We'll put people back to work, and we'll bring manufacturing home. It's time to look for solutions. Solutions that will save the entire community of life, not just one species, one disease, or one problem. This is about the well-being of the entire communion of life. And I think that clergy preaching from the pulpit about the moral basis behind environmental stewardship may have far more of an impact than a politician, certainly than a politician, and maybe even a scientist. I think that religion is beginning to play a role in this dialogue searching for solutions, but you may wonder what took so long. We are the people that pray for a reverence for the earth, and we denounce evil that destroys creation. But we let words like dominion be translated into domination instead of its true meaning, which is compassion and care. I was talking with a class earlier today and saying that we were given dominion over creation, but that dominion is love and compassion. It's the kind of dominion that parents have over their children. You don't break their ribs or give them black eyes. You help them be the best they can be. God gave us dominion to help us help this earth that He loves so much be the best it can be. So I ask you, what kind of a society continues to do things that we know are destructive? And what does that say about us as humans? What does it mean to be human in light of the climate crisis that we're experiencing? And when we know that it's a problem, we know we have a problem, we know what's causing it, and we know the solutions, and yet we do nothing, I think we have to question our ethical and moral values. What does it say about our legislators, elected officials, when they continue to avoid doing anything about this immense challenge? This is why I'm now calling it crimes against humanity. The decisions that we make today will affect neighbors near and far, and most importantly, our future neighbors, our children and their children. We have a responsibility to the next generation. We also have an opportunity, an economic opportunity on the horizon, and it's irresponsible not to take those opportunities. If I refuse to believe that we are so lacking in moral integrity that we don't care, if I thought that we couldn't do something or that we didn't care, I wouldn't have dedicated my ministry and my life to this effort, and I wouldn't have any hope, and I wouldn't be here. But recently, my hope is hanging on a thread, but I still have some, and you all coming to hear this message gives me hope. I think that we are reaching a threshold, or a tipping point, if you will, of people who are aware of the daunting issues that we face with climate change. The polls say that 85% of people say they care. It's not always a top priority, but they care. And then when you think that 65% of American people, I know that's more than in Canada, but 65% of American people attend a house of worship on a regular basis. We have a huge audience and the potential for a lot of influence. And I think, too, that the human race is evolving. Our collective consciousness. We are and we will continue to develop a shared purpose and a common goal with people all over the world, a kind of great awakening. I think we have begun to realize that environmental values have a larger ethical dimension. And the realization that we are one and that we have to work together towards a truth. And the truth is that we are one. One shared purpose, one earth, one atmosphere, one global climate. This is very full. There comes a time when we have to make a choice. And it hits you at unexpected times, and often you have to hear it more than once before you really ingest the need for change. But when that epiphany happens, there's no going back. The better choices come forward easily, and many of us are at that moment. Others are still discerning it, but I think we're all on a path of regeneration. We have to choose whether to live for ourselves alone, as we have in the past, or for our neighbors and for those who come after us. We have a choice between life and death. It is just that serious. This is the moment when we must take the responsibility for the destruction that humans have caused to creation. This is the moment when we need to pledge to take an unwavering stand to preserve and protect the creation over which we have been given dominion. And if we choose life, then we choose to live in harmony with one another and with all of creation. This is the time to make better choices. It's the time to redefine what it means to be human and to seek justice on behalf of those who cannot speak for themselves. This is a time for a generational shared purpose, one that can bring us out of recession and start healing the abused earth. Faith and hope are crucial to celebrating a shared purpose, and I do sense hopefulness around us. It's in the form of new technologies. It's in the form of religious people speaking out, and people of faith who believe in the power of the human spirit, and hope is here with you. Caring for God's creation takes on more urgency with each passing day. The climate continues to warm. Half of all the Earth's wetlands are already gone. We're losing an average of one species of plant or animal to extinction every hour. And all the while, we're consuming our weight in stuff every day. But this is not who we are. We don't have to do this. We have one earth, one shared purpose, and that's to be the stewards of creation. So we have this great opportunity now. And while the climate situation is a major crisis, and crisis is usually associated with danger, crisis also brings opportunity, and we mustn't waste this opportunity. We can run from the danger, or we can face it, and we can move forward together, unified with a shared purpose. There is unlimited and sustainable economic growth beckoning on the horizon with these new technologies to be researched and developed, creating millions of clean energy jobs. We have the tools, and I pray we have the will to make things right. It's time to put our faith into action. So let's all commit to a regeneration of spirit, both inwardly and outwardly. Commit to being an example to others and show our love for creation in all our behaviors. Choose resurrection and life over death and destruction. We are all in this together, one family with one shared purpose and one hope for all. We are here. The time is now. And I thank you for your attention.
Thank you. I just wanted to thank Sally for a great talk. I met her for the first time a couple of days ago, and really just a wonderful person, warm and dedicated. But just a couple of highlights I thought were one is redefining the human purpose. We are, you know, at a time when we have to think hard about what civilization is for, and we've really lost track of what we're trying to accomplish. We're infatuated with more consumption and growth, and it's a completely impoverished message that we hear daily from our politicians and from the press. So I think that's a wonderful thing. Let's redefine the human purpose to care for and reconstruct and restore this wonderful planet. The second thing I really liked was the notion of crimes against humanity and the issue of warrants, right? It crossed my mind immediately. And I would have a little list, you know, when you get through going through the U.S. Senate and the House, I can give you a little Canadian list to work through, too. So, it works on both sides of the border. So, thank you for this talk, your redefinition of our purposes and your life and your work. It's very, very inspiring to us all. So Sally said she would take some questions, and I'll sort of just call on people and moderate that a little bit.
Peter, your job is protection when you call people.
We have questions?
Oh, sorry. Okay. Yeah, so there are mics over here in the aisle.
Could I ask a question?
Yeah, but could you go to the mic? I think then everybody could hear it.
Do you not feel that you are up against millions of dollars of lobbying funds coming from the oil industry, the coal industry, and is there anything that can be done to overcome that?
It's a good question, and it's also very poignant for me right now. I don't know what we can do unless people like Bill Gates and George Soros and folks who have begun to understand that it is the oil industry driving a lot of the skepticism around climate change. If those folks would start creating funds for the renewable energy people to work with and to get clearer, more honest messages out. But because you brought it up, I'm going to exploit you just slightly. This is a California issue, but it's an example of what this gentleman is talking about with the oil money that comes in to influence what we do about climate and clean energy. In 2006, California passed its own regional state global warming bill to cut our carbon emissions by, I think it's 20% by 2020, and it was going into effect in 2012. It was called AB 32. Just remember that bill. Arnold Schwarzenegger, our governor, signed it into law in 2006. At the beginning of this year, and it goes into effect in 2012, at the beginning of this year, we learned that Texas oil money was coming into California, $80 million of it, to try to undo AB 32, our global warming bill. We're going to be voting on this in November, and these are the kinds of challenges that we have. They are starting to put advertisements on television to say that if AB 32, the global warming bill, goes into effect, it's going to hurt the economy and people are going to lose their jobs. And, of course, lots of people are concerned about those two things, but it is a direct lie. Believe me, I'm not speaking for the Episcopal Church. I'm speaking for myself. It's just absolutely wrong that the global warming bill when it goes into effect, will create jobs and it will boost the economy through these new technologies. And there are venture capital people who are waiting to invest their money in renewable energy, but until they know what the rules are, they're holding back on trillions of dollars of investment money. So to have the Texas oil people come into California with TV ads and postcards and billboards telling the populace that they need to, that what they did is they put a proposition that's coming up on our ballot, and it's Proposition 23, the reverse of the numbers. It is going to reverse 32. So it's very, right now, I mean, we have 4 weeks with not $80 million, but we have to somehow counter that Texas oil money and have the right thing happen. I do believe that the good guys are going to win this one, but it's an example of how do you compete with the oil industry and the amount of money they have going towards skepticism and trying to dispute the science and that kind of thing. So thank you for raising that, and I'm sorry the answer took so long.
Question over here.
Okay.
I'd like to start by saying that it's an impression to see your administrator having opinions such as yours. So thank you. My question is about I'm just wondering why is it that there are many members of the evangelical movement in the United States who are opposed to climate change or without climate change. Is it because they tend to be Republican and therefore visibly conservative? Or is this because there's an interpretation of the Bible that doesn't practice the power of you financial global warming?
This has come up a couple of times today where people are really interested in what the evangelicals think. Okay, you asked a number of questions. One is, yes, they do tend to be Republican, but not always. And to keep in mind that evangelical has a wide, wide range. You can have compassionate, kind, care for creation, much more generous of spirit on this end, and then you can have the conservative, Bible literalist, extremist on the other hand, and there's a wide range in between. There are people who think, particularly with the Bible literalist, that if they embrace the science of climate change, they will be asked to embrace the science of evolution, and the their whole theology will unravel. The good news about the evangelical community is that they do have a large number of their community who care for creation. And they have, I think they have a website that's Care for Creation, and there's a movement among younger evangelicals to not have same-sex relations and abortion be the primary issue, but have Care for Creation take the place of that and become a priority. Young people here and in our country care about the environment. And while they don't want to be in direct sort of disobedience, if you will, to their parents, there's a whole group of young evangelicals who have Care for Creation as a priority and are still within the evangelical family.
Yes, question?
Heaven knows it's very easy to enumerate the sins of the rich politicians. But actually, it seems to me the problem lies with the vast majority of the population who do very little to improve the world in which they live. This is the same people who didn't deal with genocide, with poverty, with disease, and so they find all kinds of excuses why it's too difficult, it's too unclear, it's too costly, call it what you will. So what makes you think that enough people are strong enough faith to put their beliefs into action when it hasn't been happening except for wonderful people like yourself and the small groups of people, including Peter Brown, but I would suggest which is why I think it was also connected to his Quaker belief, but that's a different story.
So let's have a question now, because I've not
noticed. Okay, my question, I did ask the question, what will it take to elevate the vast majority of apathetic people who are finding all kinds of excuses not to do anything?
Well, it's a really good question, and I wouldn't do this work if I didn't think that we were going to be influential. Just going back 10 years when I was called nasty names for talking about climate change, that doesn't happen to me anymore. 10,000 congregations around America who have joined this program to cut their carbon emissions and serve as examples to the community, these people care. The crowds are getting bigger. The voices are getting stronger, and just since the religious community entered this movement, which was really only, in a big way, about 8 years ago, the religious community has really abdicated its responsibility, but they're playing catch-up, and every single major denomination just in the last 3 to 5 years has got a statement on climate change. As I mentioned, 65% of the American people go to a house of worship on a regular basis. Those clergy people have the opportunity to be tremendously influenced. Have you ever heard of somebody called Rick Warren, who has a 20,000 mega church in Los Angeles? He's on our side. Joel Hunter, 20,000 person mega evangelical church in Orlando, Florida. He's bringing his people along. I don't think it's going to happen as fast as any of us want it to happen. This all should have happened yesterday. But I see such progress that I can't be too much despair about it, because I think it is going to happen. I believe in the human spirit, and I think we will rally enough people to make the changes we need to make.
Question over here, too, Maggie.
Okay. Well, thank you for your talk. I'm wondering, you're talking about the percentage of people that attend the House of Worship in the United States. I know that it's lower in Canada. I also know that it's lower among youth in Canada. And so I'm wondering if you can tell me what you see the role of the faith community in bridging the gap between not just having a faith discussion, but between a discussion of ethics, no matter if those ethics are based in religion or if they're based in secular ethics, and how you see that conversation moving forward and not being judgmental as to whether someone is or isn't or does not identify as a person of faith. And I think that's something I should privately figure out from a secular perspective on the West Coast, Jim Harrison. So, thank you.
I'm not 100% sure what the actual question is, but we have to all work together. It absolutely makes no difference whether you're of a mainstream religion and identify yourself that way as to whether or not you care about creation and care about the environment. You probably don't call it creation then. You would call it the environment. Bravo. What I'm excited about is the fact that the community of faith is getting involved in bringing a moral voice to the discussion. That's not to delineate or negate atheists from doing the same thing. We just all have to work together with the same purpose, this shared purpose that's going to take all of us to solve. And I don't mean to imply, which I don't think I did, that agnostics or atheists are not ethical, because they are. I have to be very careful, coming from a faith perspective, not to look like someone who worships nature or worships the environment rather than worshiping the Creator who created the environment. Do you need more?
Let's take one more question from this side and then one from that side. And then one.
My question actually kind of goes along with that. I was just wondering to what extent you were involved with, or your organization, with people of other faiths, so how involved they are with what you do in your country or abroad.
Well, the clue is interfaith power and light. The individual state programs that we have, Georgia Interfaith Power and Light, Massachusetts IPL, Pennsylvania IPO, we have in our MOU, the Memorandum of Understanding, they cannot use our name unless they have at least three different denominational representations on their board of directors. So Jews, Muslims, and Christians, Baha'is, Mormons, Buddhists, Catholics, Hindus, Evangelicals.
What about Quakers? You never mention them.
Well, and the Quakers are some of the best. We have a Quaker running our Utah Interfaith Power and Light. So all major denominations are represented. And did you mean, when you said other countries, we have a program in Sweden. I shouldn't say we do. There is a program in Sweden called Ethics and Climate, Ethics and Energy. And they copied our work, but they don't call it Interfaith Power and Light. They translated our website into Swedish, and I went there and did a presentation. It was quite fun, and so we can actually say we're international. In Australia, they have a program modeled after ours, but again, it's not called Interfaith Power and Light. Interfaith Power and Light right now is just in the United States, but they're all different. We have Jains. There's a Green Mosque in Washington, D.C. that's part of our program. We have all different. The Zen Center in San Francisco has a whole solar array on their roof.
Take one more question over here.
Thank you, Reverend, for your talk. And my question actually also has to do with that last one. And I was wondering, in terms of interfaith power and light, whether or not working in an interfaith coalition has helped in public perception of your organization, helped further your goals, or if it's proved to be a challenge.
Repeat the question, please.
Oh, sorry. Working in an interfaith coalition has helped your organization and sort of meet that goal in the eyes of the public, or have you been a challenge?
In the eyes of the public, I think it's been received very enthusiastically. And you raised something that I think you might be alluding to, but whether you are or not, I'll tell you. We started a religious response to global warming with the entire intention to have the religious community take a leadership role in the response to climate change. The unintended consequence that has been really quite magnificent is that Jews, Muslims, Christians, Baha'is, and all these different religions that often disagree with each other are sitting in the same room agreeing that we are the stewards of creation. And when we sit down, all these different religions, we always start the meeting with, we're not going to talk about where we came from or where we're going when we die. We're here on the planet now, and we are the stewards of creation. So there's a coming together of religions that have in the past been, you know, been antagonistic towards one another. But on this issue, it's bringing them together. I think the world sees it. That what I think you're asking is, what's the perception of the secular world about this? I'll tell you, the scientists are delighted. Scientists are not good messengers. They like the fact that the religious community is talking about this. Politicians invite us to stand behind them. Now, we only do this with the politicians that are on our side. But I was standing behind Arnold Schwarzenegger when he signed the AB 32 into law. They like the notion that the religious community is supporting their principles. So, by and large, it's been received quite well.
Thank you very much, Sally. It's great to have you here.